You're listening to Local Motion on KVNF. I'm Brody Wilson. This week, we have a special Local Motion for you. We're bringing you a regional roundup from Rocky Mountain Community Radio's Maeve Conran. KVNF is a member of Rocky Mountain Community Radio. It's a fantastic network of community radio stations like KVNF all over the Mountain West that come together to share stories and resources. We hope you enjoy.
Welcome to the Regional Roundup, a production of Rocky Mountain Community Radio, a coalition of public and community radio stations in Colorado, Wyoming, Utah, and New Mexico, including this one. I'm Maeve Conran, the coalition's managing editor, and on today's show, we visit the First Peoples Festival in Estes Park.
For Six Singers, contest time, gentlemen!
We learn about a program that teaches high school students trade skills and put those skills to work building affordable housing.
We have one walleye that's right and then one that's not built because I had to take it apart.
We'll hear about a recently released environmental impact statement for the Colorado River released by the Department of Interior.
You know, one of the biggest question marks is how will curtailments or scarcity or reductions in the delivery of water, how will that be allocated across the basin? How will that pain be distributed?
And a new documentary looks at the crisis in local journalism.
Journalism and the media, the greater media, is under attack right now.
From Rocky Mountain Community Radio, it's the Regional Roundup. Tribal communities from across the Rocky Mountain West gathered in Estes Park recently for the annual First Peoples Festival. Over 3 days, the First Peoples Festival brought together Indigenous artists, dancers, educators, and families for a fashion show, an art market, cultural demonstrations, and a powwow. All of it creating a space for celebration, education, and remembrance. One of the people behind the festival is Nico Strangeowl, a Northern Cheyenne cultural advocate and artist. She's the owner of Eagle Plumes Trading Post, which is a longtime Native American art hub near Estes Park.
That's the most important thing, is that we have a place for Native people to come together and to celebrate our heritage and to also, you know, educate our history and our current state, how we express ourselves through art and music, dancing, and you know, so on.
For Strangeowl, the festival is about more than art and culture. It's also about telling stories that have long been left out of history books. She's a descendant of survivors of the Sand Creek Massacre, one of the deadliest attacks on Native people in U.S. history. It was carried out in southeastern Colorado in 1864 by U.S. troops against Cheyenne and Arapaho families.
It was sort of covered up for a long time. People didn't want to talk about it. When I was growing up, my grandmother always said that had my great-grandfather not survived as an infant at Sand Creek, none of us would be here.
Strangeowl says the trauma didn't end with the massacre itself.
I know that's kind of the generational trauma is kind of an overused term, but is exactly right. So the only way to address that is to acknowledge what happened.
Strangeowl has worked with the Sand Creek Foundation, a nonprofit dedicated to education and remembrance of the massacre. Eleni Sklavenitis is the foundation's executive director. She says the goal is to centralize and preserve records that are often scattered or difficult to access.
So there are archival materials and collections about the Sand Creek Massacre in disparate collections all across the country and even throughout the world. And so one of our main projects at the foundation is to create the Center for Sand Creek Massacre Studies, which will be a repository of all of these materials so that researchers, descendants, academics can come to one place and, you know, look through vetted materials about the massacre, its context, and also its consequences.
The foundation is also raising funds for a public memorial at the Colorado State Capitol in Denver.
This will be a bronze statue, and each figure, there's Chief Black Kettle, who was the Cheyenne chief, Chief Left Hand, who was the Arapaho chief, and Medicine Woman holding a baby in a cradle board. And they're standing in front of teepee poles.
The memorial was unanimously approved by the Colorado legislature and the governor's office last spring. Organizers hope to install and dedicate it on November 29, 2026. That's the anniversary of the massacre. Education was a central focus throughout the festival, including a presentation by the Colorado Cherokee Circle.
But we not only have 470,000 Cherokee citizens, according to the U.S. government, we have 2.5 million more who claim they're Cherokee citizens.
My name is Jim Kemp, Castle Rock, Chinela. I'm from Castle Rock, originally from Claremore, Oklahoma. I want to dispel the mythology that surrounding Native American populations and peoples.
Kemp says he speaks at events like this to challenge narratives that still shape how Native history is taught.
I want the real story to be told about what our cultures went through. In the Declaration of Independence of the United States, their doctrine is that we were merciless savages, and it's written right into that document.
He told the audience that those myths ignore the complexity and the structure of indigenous societies.
And one of the things they don't understand is that we were actually a more civilized people than the civilization that they brought to us. We didn't have jails because we didn't need jails. We had law and order. We had a system by which our people lived in harmony with one another. We understood the Creator. We understood creation. We understood our place within the earth. We understood what it was for us as a people to be owing to our ancestors and fulfill their legacy for us, while at the same time creating a safe legacy for the next seven generations coming after us.
Kemp also volunteers in schools across Wyoming, Utah, and Colorado, teaching students about Cherokee history and governance. In the adjacent building, dancers, singers, and drummers from across the region gathered for the powwow.
Their style is awesome. You're going to see a big treat. We're going to go to Forest Lake Singers. Contest time, gentlemen. You are on the air.
Morning Mist Atz is Cheyenne and Arapaho. She traveled from Lakewood to compete in the Teen Jingle Dance.
It was a pretty hard competition with 4 push-ups for each sidestep. The sidestep is pretty hard because you're just going up and down on your tippy toes, and it really works out your calf muscles, which is really like strenuous on your legs.
Her regalia carries deep meaning.
These cones on here, they're made of tobacco lids, and people pray with them, so that's why it's a healing dance. Each one is rolled and then prayed on. And once you dance, all the prayers go out and to everybody else.
The powwow ended with 2 special dances, a red dress dance and a red shirt dance, honoring missing and murdered Indigenous women and relatives. Ahead of the dances, Lynette Grable addressed the crowd. She's the founder of the advocacy nonprofit, Not Our Native Daughters.
We do these specials at powwows not only to bring awareness, but we want to let our tribal relatives know that if they're ever in a situation where their loved one is missing or murdered or trafficked, that they can contact us and we have financial support for families who are facing this issue, whether they're currently missing, whether it's a cold case, or whether it's a human trafficking situation.
Grable serves on Colorado's Missing and Murdered Indigenous Relatives Task Force and helped create a similar task force in Wyoming.
We also understand how the federal and state level can sometimes just look away at our cases, but we're not going to stand here and let them look away. We support our relatives when they're facing this situation, and we'll make damn sure that every time this case happens, that they pay attention and there is accountability. Yeah!
As the powwow winds down, dancers, singers, and drummers prepare to return home to Utah, Wyoming, New Mexico, and Montana, as well as to communities across Colorado. They're already looking ahead to the next gathering on the powwow circuit, including the Denver March Powwow, the largest in the state, which is set for just 2 months from now. For Rocky Mountain Community Radio, I'm Maeve Conran. Affordable housing and a shortage of skilled construction workers are big challenges across the Rocky Mountain West. A school district in Boulder, Colorado, is partnering with the city and with Habitat for Humanity to teach kids trades by building homes working people can afford. KGNU's Sam Fuqua reports.
We're inside a 32,000 square foot factory where modular homes are in various stages of construction. High school teacher Darren Rasmussen and student June Baker huddle over blueprints, figuring out what went wrong with a drywall installation.
There are actually multiple wall A's. So what didn't happen, like this was the original and you said it was way too small?
We have one wall A that's right and then one that's not built because I had to take it apart. But I've learned my mistake and then they realized from that mistake that they need to start labeling each wall with numbers.
The city of Boulder built this $13 million factory on land owned by the Boulder Valley School District, with help from state, federal, and private foundation grants and loans. And it pays for the materials used to build the houses. Students get hands-on experience building homes and course credit. The local Habitat for Humanity chapter manages the program. All the groups involved say the three-way partnership is the first of its kind in the nation.
There's so many various sort of values that come together.
Kurt Fernhaber is Boulder's Housing and Human Services Director.
Educating our young people into the trades and creating opportunities for them. It's an opportunity to grow the local Habitat affiliate to produce many more homes and to control the environment and how those homes will be built in a net zero factory.
Net zero means the factory's total energy use is equal to the amount of renewable energy created on-site or off-site through a combination of clean technologies. Ready up there? In November, they trucked their first two homes a few miles away to the Ponderosa Mobile Home Park, where they were hoisted by crane onto foundations. High school senior Sean McCormick was helping out.
I think it was a big accomplishment for us and what we can do in the future and all the problem solving we had to do. And because it's not like we're building a little mini project, it's real world type stuff.
McCormick plans to go to trade school to become an electrician or pipe fitter. The industry group American Institute of Constructors estimates the U.S. will need more than 500,000 workers to keep up with demand. After this mobile home park flooded, the city bought it, fixed problems, and began working with Habitat for Humanity on upgrading the housing. Dan McCauley is CEO of Flatirons Habitat for Humanity.
So the families who are getting houses here have been living in substandard housing, some of them for decades.
Residents have the option of staying in their mobile home or buying one of these new modular houses.
All of these families will have a mortgage. The mortgage is based on their ability to pay and their income, so there is a significant subsidy involved.
The three-bed, two-bath homes are 1,150 square feet. McCauley estimates costs will range between $350,000 and $450,000. The median price of a single-family home in Boulder last year was over $1.3 million. Maribel Gonzalez-Rodriguez is one of the new homeowners. She lives in a small, older mobile home just steps away from her new house. She'll move into it soon.
Me siento muy emocionada porque nos están dando la oportunidad de tener nuestra propia.
She says it's incredibly exciting that she gets to have her own house. Her trailer right now is two bedrooms and there's not a lot of space. She's a single mom with four kids. They share the bedrooms. Maribel sleeps on the couch. She's lived in Boulder almost 25 years and works in the kitchen of a downtown hotel.
Y lo que me gusta es que no me voy a mover de Boulder y tengo el área más, la vista más bonita de...
She'll have her own upstairs bedroom with, she says, the prettiest view in Boulder. I'm Sam Fuqua.
You're listening to the Regional Roundup from Rocky Mountain Community Radio. Recently, the Federal Department of the Interior released a draft environmental impact statement for the Colorado River Basin and its two largest reservoirs, Lake Powell and Lake Mead. The river's current operating guidelines expire this year, and the document lays out potential scenarios for allocating water into the future. It comes in the middle of contentious negotiations between the states that use the river over who will bear the burden of cuts to water usage as drought continues. To find out what this means, our rural climate reporter, Caroline Yonas, spoke with Chris Winter, the director of the Getchess Wilkinson Center at CU Boulder's School of Law.
So to give a little bit of background, the seven states that rely on the Colorado River have been negotiating how to allocate that water after 2026. And those negotiations are divided between the upper basin states of Colorado, Utah, Wyoming, and New Mexico, and the lower basin states of Arizona, California, and Nevada. So where does the Bureau of Reclamation and the Department of the Interior fit in with that larger context? And what is this draft environmental impact statement that they just released?
Yeah, really good question. So the dams and the reservoirs are large federal projects, Lake Powell and Lake Mead. And so the Secretary of the Interior is responsible for releasing water, producing power, and otherwise managing those big pieces of federal infrastructure. So it's ultimately the Secretary of the Interior's decision as how to operate those units. But the Secretary is looking to the states, the seven basin states, to see if they can come up with an agreement amongst themselves as to how to allocate, a resource that is dealing with some real scarcity issues. And so the Secretary of the Interior was hoping that the seven basin states could reach a consensus agreement on how to address the scarcity problems in the system. And in past years and decades, the states have been able to come up with agreements amongst themselves. And then the secretary says, great, I'm glad you all have an agreement. We'll implement that through the federal system. So that's what's happening right now, is the Secretary of the Interior is getting ready to make a decision, but the secretary is really hoping the states will bring to the secretary a consensus agreement on how to move forward. And so that's the situation that we're in right now. We have a deadline for these new operating guidelines. Secretary has to make a decision by October of 2026, which means there has to be some work that happens before that. So this draft EIS was published to lay the groundwork for that final decision to come. In the meantime, everybody is waiting for the states to see if they can come up with some type of consensus agreement that the secretary might incorporate into this decision. And of course, that's a preferred outcome, because if there's a consensus agreement, that resolves the threat of litigation and other types of disputes further down the road.
So thinking about this 1,600-page environmental impact statement, or EIS, was there anything about what the Interior is proposing that stood out to you or struck you as unusual?
Typically, when the federal government releases a draft EIS, it says, here's a number of different alternatives as to how we could approach the problem. And then here's our preferred alternative. This is what we think we're going to do when we issue a final, but we want to take public comment on that. In this situation, the federal government's laid out five alternatives, but there's no preferred alternative. And that's because the government wants to leave the states the room to negotiate what they think is the alternative. And so this is a very unique draft environmental impact statement, because there was no preferred alternative that was laid out in the document. Instead, what the government said is, here's five alternatives. We think that all of the different elements that are baked into those five alternatives will eventually be part and parcel of whatever consensus agreement the states come up with. So we think all the elements are in there, but they haven't been packaged together by the states. So we think this is enough for now. and we'll see if the states can come up with something out of all these things that we've laid out. So that's the hope, and it's a fairly unusual posture, I guess I would say.
Tell me a little bit more about what was in some of those alternatives. What are some of the scenarios that the Interior is thinking about in the future for the Colorado River?
You know, one of the biggest question marks is how will curtailments or scarcity or reductions in the delivery of water, how will that be allocated across the basin? How will that pain be distributed? And how does the secretary make those decisions? And so one of the important things for everybody to know is that the secretary has a lot more authority to reduce the amount of water that's consumed with respect to the lower basin. So the secretary is the water master essentially for the lower basin, because the Secretary of the Interior delivers water to the lower basin through federal contracts, and those are associated with the federal infrastructure, the dams and the canals in the lower basin. The upper basin is much different, and the Secretary of the Interior doesn't have legal authority over how much water upper basin water users consumptively use in the same way that the Secretary does over the lower basin. And so this draft EIS really kind of lays that out, because it's placing the bulk of the reductions in consumptive water use on the lower basin moving forward in times of really extreme scarcity. Basically, the EIS says, well, here's a variety of different ways we can address this, but almost all of the pain in the secretary's plan is on the lower basin. The lower basin has to take the bulk of those cuts. And so this is really the core of the standoff that's been standing in the way of a consensus agreement, is this question about how meaningful will the upper basin participate in reductions in consumptive water use moving forward in times of severe scarcity. And that fundamental question is very much laid out in the draft EIS, and that's informed by what legal authority the secretary has over the upper basin as opposed to the lower basin.
So we know that climate change plays a really big role in drought and the aridification that we're seeing of the Colorado River Basin. However, the Trump administration does not like to acknowledge climate change or its associated impacts. So do we see any references to the reality of climate change in this document?
So I think we all know, the scientific community, the water community, you know, everybody out there that are that's kind of operating in the real world, I think we all see and feel the effects of climate change. We know that we are dealing with conditions that are hotter and drier and more challenging now. And I think we all intuitively feel this connection to the broader challenge of climate change that we're facing. Now, the draft EIS doesn't really talk about it in those terms. So if you run a search for the term climate change in the 1700 pages of the EIS, you're not going to find it. I don't think it shows up one time in the entire document. But they talk about climate trends. So that's kind of the catchphrase that's replaced climate change. So the EIS does talk about climate trends and the impact that will have on hydrology over time. So it's incorporated into there in that way. But, you know, it's kind of framed up in a way that I think maybe addresses the administration's political priorities of not really talking about it in those terms. You know, they don't say it's human caused, they don't call it climate change, but they, you know, the EIS acknowledges that there's going to be changes in hydrology over time. And so that's just kind of where we are. It's a little bit frustrating, but I hope that it won't stand in the way of the secretary making the right decision and the states coming to an agreement.
That was Chris Winter, the director of the Getches Wilkinson Center at CU Boulder's School of Law, speaking with our rural climate reporter, Caroline Yonas. Truth Be Told is a new documentary that explores the vital role of local journalism in sustaining informed communities and a healthy democracy. The 45-minute film features five Colorado media outlets, including KSUT Public Radio. KSUT's Tammy Graham spoke to filmmaker Brian Malone, who's behind the project.
Brian, why was this film so important for you to make at this time?
Well, I don't think it's any secret that journalism and the media, the greater media, is under attack right now. Journalism is at, as trust in journalism is at, as an all-time low in general right now. And I think that's a problem, because Journalism is considered the fourth estate in our government. We journalists hold the other three branches of government to account, and other people in power, institutions of power, to account. And so it's vital to a free and open democracy. And it's vital that journalism is a trusted institution. Yet for many reasons, and I'm not saying that those reasons are not entirely invalid, journalism is not entirely trusted. So I think it's important to shine a spotlight on the good work that journalists around Colorado are doing. And so this film highlights some of those journalists and the work that they're doing and the hard work that they're doing in digging up stories that matter to Coloradans across the state.
Talk to us a little bit about, in addition to KSUT, the other media outlets that are featured in this documentary.
Sure. I tried to get a good cross-section of journalists, rural, urban, from across the state, and different mediums, print, radio, online, television, and the different work that they do and the different types of work that they do. So viewers that watch the film could basically see kind of how the sausage is made in a way, and basically get an understanding, a better understanding at the work that's being done to tell a story and how much work it actually takes to go into digging up facts, interviewing people, going to the scene of a story and getting both sides of a story, or in some cases, in many cases, more than both sides of a story, many sides of a story, and how complex it is to tell an accurate story, and how things are a lot more complicated than you might think.
A lot more complicated, and it's expensive to produce local news is another element that I think a lot of folks aren't aware of.
But also important. Important to understand. Important to understand that, you know, there is a lot of noise right now. A lot of loudmouths out there. I call them loudmouths, making noise. And it's easy to get distracted. It's easy to get discouraged. It's easy to get angry and confused. And it's easy to bury your head in the sand and say, I don't know who to believe. I get that. I totally get that. And it's easier to say, you know, turn on a series on Netflix or whatever and just binge and forget about the day's events. You know, I'm tempted to do that too, just like everyone else is. Because, you know, a lot of the news ain't great. But it's so critical to be informed, because I guarantee you around every corner, there's some sort of opportunist or public official or local, in many cases, local politician, local official, who's trying to rig the system to try to take advantage of you, the common citizen. And it's happening, I guarantee you, it's happening where I live here in Castle Rock and in Douglas County every single day. And you need good journalists to uncover that corruption, big, small, whatever, to try to take power away from you, to try to take money away from you, to try to take agency away from you. And I guarantee it's happening down in Durango right now.
Filmmaker Brian Malone was speaking with KSUT's Tammy Graham about the new documentary, Truth Be Told. You've been listening to the Regional Roundup, a production of Rocky Mountain Community Radio, a network of public and community radio stations in Colorado, Wyoming, Utah, and New Mexico, including this one. Thanks to KGNU's Sam Fuqua, our rural climate reporter Caroline Yanez, and KSUT's Tammy Graham for today's show. Our theme music is Take Me Somewhere by Joel Adam Russell. I'm Maeve Conran. Thanks for listening.
This has been Locomotion on KVNF. I'm Brody Wilson. Thanks so much for listening. Locomotion airs every Tuesday at 5 p.m. and Saturday at 10 a.m. If you ever miss a Locomotion On Air that you want to hear, you can always find past episodes by looking under the news tab at kbnf.org and looking for Locomotion. Thanks so much for listening.